Okay, this time it is 9:30, so I'm gonna actually start. So as you can see, I've got the 400 years of silence, the 400 years between the Old and the New Testament. And ideally, this would have followed up immediately after our study of the Minor Prophets. That's the way it was scheduled. I appreciate Kyle switching with me last week because I was out of town. So this is a little bit out of order, I guess. I've asked these guys to pass out a timeline, and there should be plenty of copies for everybody that wants one. This timeline covers a variety of things from that 400 years. I'm not going to cover everything on that timeline. My plan is to cover the things that are in bold. I hope I'll be able to get to those at least. But there's some other stuff just for reference information, that type of thing. There is a lot to cover if my math is correct, which it probably isn't, but I've got 40 minutes and 400 years, so that's 10 years a minute. So we're going to be moving pretty quick. This is much more of a lecture than what I usually like for class. I usually like a lot of discussion. I don't have any places where I plan on asking for questions. But if you have a question, speak up. I don't want you to be lost because I have some agenda that I'm trying to get through. So if you need clarification, you have a question, there's an issue, something I say, is this not right, whatever, then speak up and we'll address that. I did notice one typo on the timeline. On the back page towards the bottom, the year 60-4 says the first triumvirate ruled Rome. That should be 60-48. So the first triumvirate didn't last that long. Obviously, all the dates are going backwards because it's B.C. Paul. I only bolded the important things. So in this 400 years of silence, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, and a lot can change in 400 years. And to kind of make me think about that, I thought about the North America 400 years ago, 1624. Obviously, a very, very different place than where we are today, 2024. For those of you that are kind of history buffs, you know, you have these 13 colonies. They're going to eventually have some sort of little revolution and whatever. In 1624, there's two of the 13 colonies. And neither one of them are very big. The bigger one is Jamestown, Virginia. There's probably about 1,200 people there out of the 8,000 that have come over. Most of them have died. So you've got St. Augustine, Florida. You've got Quebec up in Canada that's a French settlement. And you've got about 13 families that are Dutch that are in what is now New York. That's pretty much the European presence in North America in 1624. So a whole bunch happens right between 1624 and 2024, and we're looking at the same time period between the Old and the New Testament. Not the first time that we've had a big gap, a big jump. We've got about a 300-year jump between Genesis, the end of Genesis, and the beginning of Exodus. And again, a lot happens. You're reading through your Bible, you get to the end of Genesis, you've got, you know, this small group of Jews in a very powerful position, and you go 300 years later, you turn the page, in my Bible, you turn the page, the next page, and suddenly you've got a million Jews, but they're in slavery, the Pharaoh doesn't know, you know, anything about Joseph and the past and all that kind of stuff. So this is not a new concept to have a jump in time without a lot of background, a lot of information. And we see this huge jump, whoops, went too far, we see this huge jump obviously between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And so just a few things here that have changed. At the end of the Old Testament, the Jews were under the control of Persia. Again, we just went through and studied that with the minor prophets. They'd returned and rebuilt the temple and all that. Now in the New Testament, they're under the control of Rome. In the Old Testament, the center of power was the East. Most recently, the capital was Susa. Now the capital is in the west, in Rome, and that's the center of everything. You've got a tiny little temple. Remember, they were very disappointed about how small the temple had been. And now in the New Testament, you have this massive new temple that had been built by Herod, really as a building project to create jobs and pride in the community and that type of thing. The Jews didn't have a king at the end of the Old Testament. Now you have a king, but he's not Jewish. He's not God's chosen. He's a Roman official, basically, that has that title. In the Old Testament, we had the priests that were descendants of Aaron, part of the Levitical priesthood. Worship is centered in the temple. And now you have still a high priest, but it's a political position. It's bought oftentimes. Center of worship is oftentimes now in synagogues. We have these synagogues scattered all over. And so a lot of things have changed. It's a totally different world. I kind of compare it if you've been to a play. You see a scene, the curtain drops. A few minutes later, the curtain opens. Different characters, different setting, different situation. That's kind of what happened in that 400 years. Things have changed very, very dramatically in that amount of time. All right, so a couple things I want to mention right off the bat. First of all, the 400 years of silence is not completely silent in the sense that we don't have any revelations from God. We don't have God speaking through prophets, etc. But the Old Testament is there. The Bible, as it exists, obviously you can't have a New Testament yet because none of that's happened, but the Old Testament is there. It's established. People could refer to it. Today, we live in another silent era, right? God's not speaking directly to us. Once Revelation was written, we don't have any more revelation. But we have the Bible. We've got God's Word. We can look at it. We can interpret how it applies to our lives. They could have done the same thing. Some people did. A lot of people didn't. So that's something I want you to keep in the back of your mind. What we're in today is not dramatically different than what their situation was at that point. There's two big things happening, in my eyes, in this 400 years. The first one is that a lot of the prophecies are being fulfilled. A lot of the things that were spoken of in the Old Testament are being fulfilled. I'm not really planning on spending much time on that. In fact, I have a single slide on that. That could be another class or series of classes. In fact, we've looked at it that way in the past. What I want to focus on is the second thing there. The stage was being set, again, that change of scene. It's a different world. You turn that Bible a couple pages, and suddenly we're in a different era, different situation, and I want to look at sort of how all that occurred. So we'll spend a little bit of time on how the prophecies were fulfilled, but most of our time, hopefully, on this idea of the stage being set. And I've got a quote there from Haley's Bible Handbook. Meantime, God in His providence was making ready the nations. Greece united the civilizations of Asia, Europe, and Africa and established one universal language. Rome made one empire of the whole world, and Roman roads made all parts of it accessible. The dispersion of the Jews among the nations thus paved the way for the propagation of the gospel of Christ in their synagogues and their scriptures. This is why it says in Galatians 4:4 that when the fullness of time had occurred. Okay, a lot had to happen in that 400 years to get to the perfect situation, the perfect time for Christ to come, and ideally, if man would have had an open mind and an open heart, we would have had, you know, more people obviously accept that Christ was the Son of God, just like today. If people would look at the Bible with an open mind and an open heart, I think there'd be a lot more conversions than what there are. All right, so as far as the prophecies go, we'll try that. Technology. That's one of the better things in 400 years, right? They didn't, 1624, they didn't have to deal with this. All right, so prophecies are being fulfilled, and I just want to very briefly mention Daniel, because Daniel obviously has quite a few prophecies. Chapter 2 and chapter 7 are represented here on the far right. You've got the statue vision that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2, and then Daniel's vision in chapter 7. And one thing I want to point out is that when the Old Testament ends, we're in that second box down. And when the New Testament begins, we're in the fourth box. So again, we've got a bit of a jump there as far as the different nations and the things that are happening in that time period. So we had prophecies saying there's going to be these new nations, and these new nations are going to be able to do these things, are going to be powerful, and this and that's going to occur. Again, these prophecies are so specific that a lot of people didn't think that they were prophecies, that they were written after the fact, and we, of course, can show that that's not the case. But they're very, very detailed, very, very specific. Chapter 8, we have more details on the Persians and the Greeks, and again, these were groups that didn't exist when Daniel was writing around 500, 600 B.C. Chapter 9, you've got the 70 weeks, which we've studied before. And then chapter 11 is the one that really is amazing to me. You have very specific details in Daniel chapter 11 about this upcoming battle between the king of the north, the king of the south, and we'll talk about that more specifically in a little bit. But what all of this does is shows that God's word is true, that God is in power, that God has control of things. If we would believe him, listen to him, obey him, things are going to work out just fine. And that was all there. And so as we see Christ appear and fulfilling all those prophecies related to him, again, people should have been maybe more willing, easy for me to say now, but people should have been more willing to accept that was the truth and he was the Son of God. And again, that's really all I want to say related to the prophecies. What I really want to spend my time on is that shifting stage, the things being different than what they were. So I've got on the timeline, I've got four time periods that are emphasized. We've got the Persian period, the very first thing listed on there, Persian period for the Jews. And first of all, I want to mention on this timeline these dates. Some of these dates are more approximate, some are definitely set. And I didn't bother to put in the ones, you know, estimate or circa or whatever on those. But and also I want to mention that some of these dates are specifically for the Jews. So for example, when we get down the second time period that we'll look at is the Hellenistic period, about two-thirds of the way down. And I've got 331 to 166. That's the Hellenistic period for the Jews. That's the time that they were controlled by the Greeks. Historians would say that the Hellenistic age is probably 335 to 27, because that's how they look at it. But anyway, there's four time periods. We've got the Persian period. And the Persian period, really what we emphasize or what we know about the Persian period is what we've studied over the last several weeks in the Minor Prophets. The Persian period begins when Cyrus defeats Babylon. The Persian Empire is in control. Again, that's in 536. He allows the Jews to return, to rebuild the temple, to rebuild Jerusalem. That all takes place. When the Old Testament comes to an end around 430, we still have about 100 years that the Jews are under control of the Persians, and we're not really told much, you know, from a historical perspective what's going on. It's probably just more of the same. They're kind of free to do what they want. They kind of have some, obviously, internal issues, et cetera, et cetera. But we're just not told a whole lot, at least that I was able to find, and it probably matters all that much. So this period begins in the Old Testament, continues, you know, into this kind of silent era, as it were. And again, in this time period, the focus is still on the east. The capital is Susa, which is right up in here. It's a nice pointer. The focus, again, is on kind of eastern things, what it has been for some time. Okay, that's going to start to change dramatically in 331. And again, the Hellenistic age for the Jews starts in 331. Alexander the Great is going to take over his father's empire, or his father's kingdom, really, at that point, in 336. And that's what historians will call the beginning of the Hellenistic Age. But it really doesn't affect the Jews until 331. Alexander the Great was the son of Philip of Macedon. Macedon was his kingdom north of Greece. Philip built up the power of Macedon. Macedonia defeats Greece, becomes part of his empire. Things are going great. He dies. His son is 20. Alexander, at that point, he's just Alexander. He hasn't anything to be great yet. But he very quickly begins this expansion. And he starts off and he heads south, basically, and west, because he's from the west. He considers himself a Greek. He was tutored by Aristotle as a boy. Pretty good tutor. But then he very quickly starts to head east. And one thing I will mention is this map doesn't look a whole lot different than the previous map, the map of the Persian Empire. But the difference is the mindset. Okay, so Alexander considers himself a Greek. He's a Westerner. That's going to be the influence. So now instead of this big Eastern Empire with some lands in the West, now it's an empire controlled from the West. And that's going to start to change things, as we'll see, as we move forward. 331, Alexander defeats Darius III at Arbela, which is right up in here. That's when the Persian Empire basically comes to an end. That's when the Jews are now firmly under the control of what is now Alexander's empire. And the Hellenistic Age, all that means, it's a blending of cultures. So what Alexander did is he conquers this massive empire and has huge success, gets all the way to India. What he does is he just blends things together. I'll take a little bit of this, I'll take a little bit of that. Again, Greek is going to become the official language of the empire, although people still spoke the local language, whatever it happened to be. But Greek was the official language, the center of power is now further west and all that. Now, Alexander's going to die young, and so he's not going to make all the changes he might have wanted to. But that's the beginning of change. This is just a bigger, same map, still kind of hard to see. But he really did is traveled through and conquered lands, changed names of cities. There's a whole bunch of Alexandrias because he liked to name stuff after himself. He named one town after his horse. But he goes through and he makes all these changes. And again, for the Jews, there wasn't a whole lot of influence on them at this point. As I already said, Greek was the official language. But for the Jews, he kind of allowed them to do their own thing. He did allow them to continue to worship. And that's going to become important because one of the things we're going to see in this Hellenistic age is a lot of people are going to adopt the Greek ways. They're going to fully accept the Hellenistic changes. The Jews tended to still be more separate. They still worshiped the true God. They obviously do start to speak Greek. We see more and more people doing that, but they still see themselves as a separate people. And you know, we get 100 years into the Hellenistic age, and most of the other civilizations that had been sort of separate have sort of blended in by that point. And that's going to create some issues for the Jews going forward. He did encourage Jews to settle, not all Jews obviously, but some Jews to settle in Alexandria, Egypt. That was a center of learning. One of the ways you learn is to communicate with other people, talk to them, get their ideas. So he wanted educated Jews to, you know, come to Alexandria, tell us what you believe and all that kind of stuff. So again, there's some freedom of movement. Some people moved for business purposes, whatever. So we also see this continuing dispersion of Jews, Jews moving to different locations, kind of spreading out. And again, they were free to do so in this time period. Now, things are going to start to drastically change for the Jews when Alexander dies. Unexpectedly, he's only 33. He dies. He actually happens to be at Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon. He gets sick. He dies. He doesn't have an heir. There's no plan of succession. This is all sort of fluid at this point. He's just running around conquering people. He has a son that'll be born after he dies. But when he dies, who's in power? Who's going to run the show? And he has four generals, and they end up dividing up the empire. And the names are shown here, and they all have different regions they control. For the Jews, this is very bad, because what happens is they're stuck kind of between the Ptolemy and the Seleucid empires. So they're kind of in this buffer zone. And one of the things all of these generals wants is more power. They're not necessarily happy with where these lines are. I want more power. I want to be the next Alexander. I want to be Ptolemy the Great, right? I want this whole thing. And so the Jews are caught in the middle. And back and forth, there's this fighting that occurs between the Egyptians and the Syrians, or the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, or whatever you want to call it, the kings of the north, the kings of the south. And the Jews are stuck in the middle of all that. And they're going to be invaded several times until finally the Ptolemies win control. And when that occurs, and I will mention, by the way, that again, a lot of that was specifically prophesied in Daniel 11, a lot of that fighting, a lot of the conflicts and stuff that go on. But once the Ptolemies win control, again, things calm down for the Jews. The Ptolemaic, or the Egyptian rulers, gave them a lot of freedom, gave them the opportunity to continue to worship the true God and do what was right and that type of thing. There was further blending. Again, Greek language, art, literature, things like that were happening. But overall, they were given quite a few freedoms. Now, one thing that is interesting that happens in this time, King Ptolemy II wanted to have the Bible, the Old Testament as it was, which again would have been scrolls and that type of thing. He wanted that to be more available to the people to read it. And again, there's other gods and religions and thoughts out there. But he began this process of having the Septuagint written. So around 250, we have the Septuagint completed, which is the translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek. And I mention that because that's the Bible that was readily used by the time Christ arrives. So when we're in the New Testament time period and people reference Old Testament, they're referencing what is now the Greek Old Testament, the translated Old Testament that they have. Okay? I don't know if that's a big deal. It'd be like us, you know, somebody saying, well, in my Bible it says blah, 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 and they're reading the NIV and somebody else is looking at the ESV. It's a different translation. But that occurred in 250. The other thing that is starting to happen in this time period, we do have what is called the Apocrypha, which is the 14 extra books that's in the Catholic Bible. Those are also being written in this time period. This starts probably around 300, and the last ones weren't written until probably around 30 or 40 BC. And those will be, some copies of the Septuagint have those extra books in them. When the Latin Vulgate is written, which is the Bible that the Catholic Church officially adopted, they included those 14 books, which was kind of a shock to me. I went to technically a Jesuit university, Creighton University in Omaha, and I took a class, I can't remember what it was, some religion, and I remember the first day the teacher said, now look, turn to the book of Judith, and I was like, something wrong here. But anyway, so that's kind of where that comes from. Okay, so in this era, and there's this whole bunch of different books with different things, we won't get into that. But anyway, so all that's, again, overall things not too bad. 198 things start to change drastically. Okay, so 198 is when things start to fall off as far as the power, the rights of the Jews. The Syrians take over. Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great from Syria, he comes in and he conquers Judea. And his goal was to be the next Alexander. He really wanted to take all of this area that had been Alexander's and make it his. The problem is that there's a growing power in the West called Rome, and they're a bit of a threat. And so he decides the key thing he has to do is to get everybody totally unified. I can't have this outlier. I can't have this extra group over there that sort of feels like they're independent and they can worship how they want and whatever. So he starts this crackdown against the Jews. He starts to search for any Bibles, any of those Septuagints that are around, and destroying them. He starts to put restrictions on the Jews. They can't observe the Sabbath. You have to work on those days, et cetera, et cetera. And this is only going to get worse with a guy named Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. And he is especially brutal towards the Jews. And he takes power, as it says there, in 175. And he starts this very harsh crackdown. He doesn't allow circumcision. He puts all these new rules in place. He sends his army around to enforce these things. And that's going to lead to the next period, the Maccabean Revolt, which we'll get to in just a second. 168, Epiphanes went to Egypt and supposedly had gotten killed in battle. And when news got to Jerusalem that he had been killed in battle, there were huge celebrations. Well, he hadn't been killed in battle. So when he finds out that the Jews are celebrating his death, he decides he's going to show them. So he goes back to Jerusalem. As it says there, he kills over 40,000 people. I'm not dead. Look what I can do. And he starts this massive crackdown. He slaughters a pig on the altar. He spreads the blood of the pig throughout the altar. I mean, these horrible things that very offensive, obviously, to the Jews are taking place in this time. Now, brief side note, while all this is going on, one of the things I had on that early slide in the Old Testament was that the Jews tended to be pretty united. By the time we get to the New Testament, we know that they're very divided. You have the Sadducees, the Pharisees, there's other groups with different views. And all of that started in this era. The Jews were conflicted over how to handle this Greek influence. Should we cooperate with the Greeks? Should we not cooperate with the Greeks? And that's really kind of where the Pharisees and the Sadducees began. And I don't know what the exact numbers were as far as what the percentages. The Pharisees definitely early on were the larger group. The Sadducees were smaller. The Sadducees tended to be wealthy aristocratic types, and they were more willing to compromise with the Greeks because they were happy to keep their position. Let's just not stir things up, and let's just keep coasting along, and I'll stay powerful. The Pharisees were less willing to cooperate with the Greeks. They seemed to be with the bigger group early on. How many people got into this conflict, I don't really know. Keep in mind that the average person probably is just trying to survive. I compare it kind of to the start of the American Revolution. The typical saying is a third of the people in the colonies in 1776 were patriots wanting to break away, a third were loyalists wanting to stay, and a third were just happy to be there. And that's probably the same situation here. A lot of people, a lot of the Jews, you know, the Greeks are here, there's some stuff going on, but I've got to work tomorrow, you know, I've got this paper due, I can't get my PowerPoint to work, whatever it might be. And so there were some issues that it varied. But as things progress, we're going to see these differences are going to increase, accelerate, and become more important. All right, so Epiphanes is this horrible, rotten guy. He's sending troops from town to town to enforce his rules. Soldiers come to the town of Modin, which is northwest of Jerusalem. There's a priest there by the name of Mattathias, and he refuses. The army comes in and says, you're going to sacrifice a pig on the altar, and he says no. And that's really kind of the beginning of this uprising that's going to take place. The story is that he refuses to sacrifice a pig. Some young kid that's there, he says, I'll do it. And Mattathias kills the kid, so they're not going to sacrifice. And that begins this huge brawl, and people join in and whatever. Now, Mattathias only lasts for a year. He dies, so this revolt begins. And again, I don't know exactly how big it is, how many people are joining in, how many people are afraid to, whatever. But when he dies, his son is going to take over, his son Judas, and his son took the name Maccabee. So we call it the Maccabean Revolt because of the term he took. Maccabee just meant hammer. So I'm going to pound these Syrians into submission. I'm going to show them who's boss. And so that's kind of where it comes from. It's sometimes called the Hasmonean or the Osmonean period as well. That's because of the Hebrew name of Simon, who we'll mention briefly. But the big turning point in all this, 2 or 12? Okay, I was about to panic. Thank you. I'm close to panicking anyway. But anyway, so he's got the revolt has begun, and Judas is having some success. But the big turning point, 165, what they call the Battle of Emmaus, the Syrians send this massive army in to crush this rebellion. And warfare back then tended to be very hand-to-hand, tended to occur during daylight hours. The Syrians are in kind of unknown territory. So they send these troops, and they're gathering together to attack against the Maccabees, against the Jews. And in the middle of the night, since they know the terrain and they know how to move around, et cetera, they launch this huge attack. And they defeat the Syrian forces. One of the key things is they capture all their weapons. They capture their supplies. So suddenly the Jews are very well armed, and momentum grows. More people that initially are going, I don't think I want to get involved. I think we're going to get killed. They're suddenly going, hey, we can win. And so this grows, and they start to have great success. So in this period, they recapture Jerusalem. The Jews recapture Jerusalem. They cleanse the temple. They reestablish it, the celebration of Hanukkah. Which is still celebrated in the Jewish community today, is celebrating the events related to that. Judas is going to rule until 161. Then he dies, and his brother Jonathan's going to come in, and his brother Simon's going to come in. And all of these guys, for the most part, are considered, you know, fairly good rulers in the sense that they were trying to restore Judaism to what it should have been. However, they were rulers. They were making changes to benefit themselves politically and powerfully and that kind of thing. So we're starting to see some shifting occur. Once Simon dies, the wheels kind of fall off. So in this Maccabean period, you know, the first 50, 60 years are pretty good overall, and then after that, things just kind of go from bad to worse as far as the rulers just copying what everybody else is doing and being power hungry and that type of thing. Simon's son John, Hyrcanus, he's going to rule from 135 to 104. He starts to accept more of the Greek ways. He starts to allow more of the changes that occur. A guy by the name of Judah comes in, and he will take the title king. He's going to say, I'm king of the Jews. So this is the first time we have a king since for the Jews since they were taken into captivity. So once again, we have that title. And things just continue. Fast forward to 66 BC, and we have two brothers, Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II, and they both really kind of wanted to rule. And this is going to lead to a civil war. And one of the things that's going on is, again, Rome is becoming more and more powerful in this time period. And as the Jews during this Maccabean revolt were worried about the Syrians, at some point, probably under Jonathan, they made an alliance with Rome. They made an agreement with Rome to help. If the Syrians become too overpowerful a force, will you help us out? So they have a tie to Rome, and that's going to end up hurting them as we go forward. So Aristobulus and Hyrcanus are having this conflict. Aristobulus was backed by the Sadducees. He was the head of the army. Hyrcanus was the high priest. He was backed by the Pharisees. They both wanted power. Initially, Hyrcanus stepped down, but there was this guy by the name of Antipater the Idumean. Idumea is down here. And he sees a chance for himself to increase his power here. So Hyrcanus had stepped down voluntarily. This Antipater guy goes to him and says, hey, I can get other rulers, other people to support you. You should fight. You should show your brother who's boss. Just because he controls the army doesn't mean that he's a big deal. So again, the civil war just kind of keeps dragging out. And eventually what's going to happen is people decide that what would maybe be good is to get the Romans involved. We've got this Roman army that's traveling around. It's been conquering. The Romans have this thing going on called the triumvirate. You have these three generals, and they're trying to rule. And they're kind of cooperating, but they're also kind of jockeying for position. One of those is a guy named Julius Caesar. He's had great success off in the West. And so a guy named Pompey is going, I need to have some success over here. I need to keep building up my resume. And so he's been defeating little places in Syria. And so what happens is really both sides, the supporters of Hyrcanus and the supporters of Aristobulus, reach out to Pompey and say, come help us. And what they're doing is they're hoping that he's going to pick one side or the other. Well, what happens is we have the beginning of the Roman period in 63. Pompey does come in with his troops. He does kind of crush the Maccabean forces that are there. And then when they all kind of turn to him and say, well, do you want Hyrcanus or do you want Aristobulus? He says, we're Roman. You're now a Roman province. So that marks the fourth and final period for the Jews during this 400 years of silence. And that sets the stage then, obviously, for Christ. There's still a lot of things that have to happen. But this stage, like the first one, the Persian stage that started in the Old Testament, went into the silent years. This Roman stage starts in the silent years and will continue then well into the Roman Empire. Pompey takes over. He makes Hyrcanus an ethnarch. An ethnarch is just a person who has control over a specific ethnic group. So he says, you know, you can be sort of our liaison between the Roman government and the Jews, but everything he does has to be okay. He's just a spokesperson, basically. That Antipater, the Idumean, is his chief advisor, and he's going to go on from there and build up his power. 47, Antipater was appointed as procurator of Judea. The procurator was kind of the financial master. His son, Herod, is made governor. Governors and procurators tended to, there's a lot of confusion, but they tended to rule together. So the governor controlled the administration. The governor dealt with enforcing the laws. The procurator dealt with the purse. He made sure the people were paid. So the one guy tells the soldiers to do this. The other guy makes sure the soldiers get paid. They have to work together. They both answer to Rome. But they're in a very, very powerful position. These are outsiders. These are not Jews. These are you know, basically now Romans that are in charge. And obviously that's going to continue. Herod will become Herod the Great. He'll be made king of Judea. He's obviously the one that's in power when Christ is born, so all of that. So we've kind of gotten to that stage. I will mention this map. This is a map that, similar to what most of you have in your Bibles, this is the Roman Empire at its height. So this is 117 AD at the time of Christ's birth. It's not quite this big, but it's pretty close. Okay, so there will be some slight expansion on the Far East and up like into England and stuff after Christ is born. The Romans are already in England. They're just going to push a little further north. This is at the end of Trajan's reign, 117. Hadrian follows him. He builds a wall in England, things slowly start to implode after that. The Romans become an empire in 27 BC. So the second triumvirate, a guy named Octavian, becomes the emperor in 27. And from that point on, the Roman Empire will be the power. So again, by the time that Christ is born, there's an empire that's in place and one ruler. And basically from 27 to 180, things are mostly good. And this map I like because this shows the Roman network of roads that were built. So again, we go back to that idea of just the right time. You have what's called the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. Starting with Octavian, going all the way through the reign of Marcus Aurelius in 180, things in the empire were pretty calm. There's fighting along the borders. There's an effort to expand. Eventually, there's going to be contraction. But for roughly a 200-year period in the empire, it's safe. There's relatively easy transport. For back then, you couldn't hop in your car yet. But some roads are paved. There's a common currency. There's a common language. So, you know, the stage is set for Paul's missionary journeys, for example. Greek is still a common language that is used extensively. Latin is the official language. If you know either one of those, you're probably good. As far as traveling around, there are still other local languages that are used as well. But if you know those, it's kind of like today. If you know English, you can probably travel lots of places and be okay. So anyway, that kind of is the situation there. So again, a lot had changed in these 400 years. A lot of things had occurred and a lot of processes. It took a lot of time, obviously, for all of this to take place. But if you go back to that original slide, the power has now shifted to the West, and you've got this massive empire. And that's going to set the stage. You've got Rome controls the northern part of Africa. They control into the east. They control into the west. There's going to be a huge opportunity for the word to spread. You've got a common language. You've got a common currency. You've got good roads. So things are in decent process there. You do have some conflicts, again, obviously, between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. In some cases, that will work to the advantage of the Christians. Keep in mind, of course, that time that... I believe it was Paul, you know, brought up the issue of resurrection, and instead of attacking him, they started attacking each other. But people should have been able to look at what was written from the Old Testament and understood what was happening. The silent years, of course, are going to come to a close. Technically, you have the angel, you know, that goes to Joseph and to Mary, but really, to me, to the masses, the silent years come to an end when we have the voice crying, "Behold the Lamb of God." And now Christ is here and things are ready to roll forward and Christianity can be established. I'm now down to like 30 seconds, so any questions, concerns? Obviously, if you have something, you're free to ask me at any point. But hopefully this was helpful. Hopefully it wasn't too fast and it was of some benefit to you. And thank you for your attention.